Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as I am joined by author and business person and microdosing coach, Paul Austin. He is the author of the book, Mastering Microdosing, and we have a nice, robust conversation about all the different angles around microdosing and what it is and what it isn't and how to go about it. And we also discuss his website, thethirdwave.co, which is built as a companion to the book, Mastering Microdosing, with all kinds of information and coaching programs about microdosing. And also, quite significantly, we discuss the company Synthesis, which recently just went bankrupt and was the training program that was training the first generation of psilocybin-assisted therapists right here in Ashland, Oregon at Buckhorn Springs. And just the other week, they went bankrupt and left all the students in a lurch, which has now been taken under the wing of another company that's coming in and doing the training program. And since Paul was involved with Synthesis, he's no longer involved. I decided that I was going to go ahead and let him jump the line of interviews that I have in the bank here waiting to come out on the podcast, because it just felt very timely and very relevant. And that's where we start off our conversation. So we'll be getting to that very, very shortly. But of course, a few quick announcements before we get there. Thanks to James and David, both of whom made donations via PayPal in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. James makes a monthly contribution, and David makes an occasional contribution every now and again. So thank you guys very much for your support via those PayPal donations. Of course, if you'd like to make a PayPal donation in support of the podcast, stop by my personal webpage, martinball.net. Use the PayPal link at the top right of the page. Also, over this past week, Josh came and signed up as a patron over at my Patreon page. So thank you very much, Josh. Appreciate that support. That's a great way to get monthly support from you to me in support of the podcast. Then also you get access to the back catalog of episodes of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast if you sign up at the $20 a month and up levels, which Josh did. So he gets access to all of those old episodes. Plus, at the $60 a month level, you get a 30-minute check-in or consultation with me, or at the $100 a month level, you get a one-hour check-in or consultation with me, just to review how things are going with you. And speaking of back episodes of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, I was quite delighted that I got a message from yet another David over this past week who said, hey, I actually have a bunch of your episodes from way back in the early years of the podcast. And we just completed a file transfer a little bit earlier today, and he got me 64 old episodes. And there's various interviews in there and all kinds of stuff. And I'll be transferring some of those over to my Patreon page as soon as I get a chance. And that, of course, is patreon.com/martinwball. Just another reminder that I'm going to be speaking at the upcoming Entheogenesis event that's being put on by the Church of Psilocybin. That's April 15th in Austin, Texas. You can go by the webpage for the Church of Psilocybin to get tickets. Of course, they have a strong presence on Facebook. You can connect with them there. So there's lots of ways that you can find tickets for that. And I will be speaking on the topic of the impact of music on entheogenic experience, and also available for a Q&A session with the audience. There's a whole bunch of different people speaking at this one-day event. It's going to wrap up with a sacrament-based ecstatic dance, which I think is going to be a lot of fun. And I'm really looking forward to getting on out there. It's been a while since I've traveled to speak publicly. It's actually been several 4 years or so, at least, since my sleep disorder manifested into its full bloom, which I've been sharing with all of you with the selections from my book, A Sleep Story, here on the podcast. And people have been asking me, well, how's it going now? Because the book that I'm sharing, the audiobook, A Sleep Story, I released that in 2021. And the answer is it's better than it was when I wrote the book. And it's certainly a lot better than it was in 2019, when it was really quite a horrific crisis. But there's still lots of room for improvement. So it's still just a part of my life. It's what I have to live with. Let's see. So there'll be another selection from A Sleep Story next week. And then I've got more great interviews for you. So just interviews, interviews, interviews. At the moment, I have way more requests for interviews and a big stack of books from authors and then promotion agents and booking agents than I can get on the podcast. So it's all just going to take time to get to all these folks. But eventually, I'll bring them out to you here on the podcast. And of course, just a reminder, I am always available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations. And that is for people who are preparing for an entheogenic experience, people who would like integration support after their entheogenic experience. And I also do basically work as a consultant for a variety of people who facilitate medicine experiences. So I'm happy to accommodate you, whatever your needs or interests are. You can stop by at nondualentheogenicintegration.com if you want any more info, or just shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com. Okay, that is all the introductory comments that I need to make for today. So let's go ahead and get into this interview with Paul Austin. I think you'll find it current and relevant, and yeah, hope you enjoy it. I had a great time speaking with Paul, and it was a pleasure to have him on the podcast. So without any further ado, let's get into it with Paul Austin. We're discussing his book, Mastering Microdosing. Okay, well, I am welcoming on to the Entheogenic Evolution podcast today Paul Austin, and he's wearing a variety of different hats on the podcast today because he is the author of the book that we're mainly going to be focusing on today, which I just finished reading a little bit earlier today. It's Mastering Microdosing, How to Use Subperceptual Psychedelics to Heal Trauma and Improve Performance and Transform Your Life. And also the founder of thirdwave.co, which is a website that has all kinds of information about microdosing. I've got that called up here on the computer. And also, just in reading the book Mastering Microdosing, saw that you were one of the founders of Synthesis, which is definitely something I want to talk to.
An interesting story, right? We should get into that. You're right there in Ashland.
So. Yeah, I am. And I will just also say, and maybe this is just word to the wise for any future potential podcast guests, but you did get to jump the list because you sent me a PDF of your book, which allows me greater ease of access. So I'll just share with you, Paul. This is the stack. This is the stack of books that you jumped
ahead. Not in His Image is a good one. Have you read Not in His Image?
No, I haven't. The only one that I've read of these is Mike Crowley's book, Psychedelic Buddhism. When I don't know, but I think that there might be something going on with Mike's health because I have not been able to get in contact with him. So I got to preview this book before it was published and read it at that point. And Mike was asking for any feedback on it. So it's at the top of my list. And but the rest of these books, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. There's 12 books here. But because you sent me a PDF, I read yours first.
And I would still love to send you a hardcover. So I actually have some of the hardcovers in front of me. And so after we get off, you know, you could send me your address. And I'm still a physical book guy. Every night before I go to bed, you know, I have a physical book that I get out and read in the mornings. I used to do Kindles. For interviews like this, I prefer PDFs as well because I can quick look, I can pull it up, I can move through it.
Yeah.
But I'm still sort of an old school guy in the physical book department too.
Yeah, so. I love having physical books as well. And I have my whole library is back over here of like all the people I've interviewed and all the authors. And there's something very satisfying about a physical book. But, you know, I, as a parent, you know, I'm taking my son to all kinds of stuff and sometimes I'm waiting around. And so if I have a PDF, I can read it on my phone when I'm just waiting in the parking lot, or I can, you know, read it at my desk, or, you know, it doesn't matter where I am versus like carrying around a physical book. So it makes it easier. And it's when we're talking about it, it's easier if it's actually on the computer and I could just scroll through rather than flipping through the book. So anyway, you got to jump the line. Congratulations, Paul.
Thank you. I'm honored. How long have you been running this podcast now? I mean, I feel like it's been years and years that I've seen you and noticed you as a host.
Yeah, I started this podcast I believe it was in January of 2008. I think it was my first episode.
I didn't even know podcasts existed.
Yeah, it was
like, you must have been early then in the game.
Yeah, it was like the baby era of podcasts. And I think at the time, there were maybe two or three other podcasts. I mean, we're talking about in the entire world, there's maybe two or three other podcasts that dealt with psychedelics. And so I got in very early, and I don't know if any of those other podcasts that were running at that time are still running. So I don't know the statistics, but I think that I might be able to claim that I have the longest running, currently still existing podcast on psychedelics in the world.
Was Lorenzo Haggerty another one? Psychedelic Salon was
yeah,
were
yeah.
they around back in yeah, I remember because yeah. he would republish talks of Terrence McKenna and Esalen and some of these epic ones which were fun, but that's amazing. Well, congratulations on the perseverance and the consistency and showing up for the art. I think that matters a lot in this space, in the psychedelic space.
Oh well, thanks. You know, I love having conversations with people. It's funny because I'm not a very social person, but I love talking to people. I really enjoy it, and that's what's kind of kept me going on the podcast. I love it. I love being able to talk to people who are bringing out new ideas, people who are new to the space, or people who are experts, or whatever. It's always interesting and fascinating, and it gives me an excuse to meet people and be social outside of my normal hermitage.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So Paul, we've got a lot to talk about, and we're going to be focusing on the microdosing and all that. But let's start with, I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about it, is synthesis. And so I'll give a little full disclosure. As you've already mentioned, yes, I am here in Ashland, Oregon, and I don't have any personal skin in the game of the psilocybin-assisted therapy. But I am the person who organized the very first public talk for Tom and Sri Eckert, who came down here to Ashland.
Phenomenal.
And that was their opening salvo into bringing out public awareness around the issue of psilocybin-assisted therapy in Oregon.
Wow.
So it happened right here in Ashland. I think it was 2015. And I think they also gave their first podcast interviews was here on the Entheogenic Evolution. And so I worked with them over the years, brought them on to kind of get updates about where things were going. And so we passed the law in Oregon. At the same time, we also passed the decriminalization law, which I think was a nice combination. And the program's supposed to be coming online this year with actually treatment and facilitation. Mm-hmm. So there's some folks who bought the Buckhorn Springs Resort out here in Ashland. And this is where we have Synthesis. So Synthesis is one of these businesses that you developed. And I believe they're out of Amsterdam or out of the Netherlands.
Yeah, we initially were out of the Netherlands. I think we also opened up an LLC in the United States, but the initial corporation was Dutch for sure.
Okay. And so Synthesis are the folks who were running the assisted therapy, psilocybin-assisted therapy trainer program. And mm-hmm. apparently something happened with finances, and so they kind of dropped out. And then I mm-hmm. just saw, so every morning I go to ijpr.org, which is the website for Jefferson Public Radio, and that's the public radio station here in Ashland. And I check out their news headlines and see what's going on locally.
See what's going on locally, right?
Yeah. And mm-hmm. so it said that another company had just stepped in and is going to be taking over the program. So a few days ago, they had Synthesis has gone bankrupt or something, and students are left in the lurch. And it was like, oh, we don't know what's going to happen with the people who are going through the program. So, yeah, I know I don't mean to be like get you, or do like a gotcha or anything like that. So
I'm prepared, and it's been interesting to witness the emergence of this. There may be listeners who have read an article or two about the situation. I'm sure a lot of listeners at the very least maybe have heard of Synthesis at some point over the last several years. And my relationship with Synthesis is really sort of a bookend relationship. I was influential in starting Synthesis. I named Synthesis. I did all the branding and initial marketing for Synthesis. The impetus of synthesis came because in 2017, early days, pre-Michael Pollan days, so to say, I was fortunate enough to speak at a couple major tech and business conferences. So one is called the Next Web in Amsterdam, and I spoke about microdosing at that. And then I also spoke at a conference that South by Southwest put on with Mercedes-Benz in Frankfurt, Germany. So I was speaking about microdosing. All these people from Daimler working at Mercedes, all these Germans are like, how can microdosing help me be more efficient and productive? You know, it was like really, really interesting.
Really? You're German. Aren't you already those things?
Right. So it was really cool to witness that. And Martijn, who was my co-founder for the for Synthesis and who is Dutch, was very influential early on in the microdosing space. So he was a co-founder of a website called High Existence, and he published an article on microdosing in like 2011 or 2012, like right after James Fadiman's book came out. And it was more or less for those years, 2012 to 2015, 2016, it was the online piece that people would refer to and go to about microdosing. And so, of course, I found it. I heard the podcast that Jim Fadiman did with Tim Ferriss. The article was phenomenal. It was about Martijn's personal experience, some of the research, some of the anecdotes. And so I reached out to Martijn in 2017 and was like, hey, I'm speaking at this conference in Amsterdam about microdosing. Do you want to attend as my guest and help me coach, you know, coach me through the process? So he attended, coached me through the process. The talk went incredible. You know, we a few months later went to South by in Frankfurt. A few months after that, I spoke at like a one-day conference in Zurich, Switzerland for a think tank. So Stephen Kotler, who wrote Stealing Fire, was the keynote. I followed Stephen Kotler. We had a number of other phenomenal speakers there. And at that conference is when we announced Synthesis to the world. And we were fortunate enough that there was a guy there attending the conference. His name is Eric. And Eric was an investor from the UK, but living in Zurich. And so he was actually, he ended up being our lead investor for Synthesis and getting behind what it is that we were doing. So this is March 2018. April 2018 are our first three retreats. We sold out our first three retreats through Third Wave, because by this time, Third Wave had been around for about 3.5 years or so. We had built an email list. We had the podcast going for a couple of years. We had content. So we said, hey, Third Wave community, do you want to attend a legal psilocybin retreat in the Netherlands with Paul and a few others? We had 25 people sign up. And because Third Wave had established so much domain authority in the psychedelic space through SEO, as soon as the Synthesis website went up, we put all these backlinks to it. So when Michael Pollan's book came out a month after that in May 2018, all these people get online and they're going, where do I find a legal psilocybin retreat? And boom, Synthesis is right there at the top. Yeah. So all of a sudden, you know, it's July 2018. We sell out two more retreats. We do three more retreats in November 2018. We sell them all out. We sell out seven retreats in total. Eight retreats in total in 2018, raised about $500,000 in investment from the investor I mentioned, as well as two others. And then we sort of, we reached this kind of crossroads, if you will, where I was still running Third Wave. It was still, you know, I had a full team for Third Wave. And we kind of had to figure out, does Paul commit to Synthesis and do this full time, or does he just step back in an advisor role? And this is when it gets interesting, because the Me Too movement and cancel culture was becoming more and more of a thing at this point.
Yeah.
And so in January 2019, I decided that I'm going to host an event with Daniel Pinchbeck, which, as you can imagine, didn't go over so well with a few specific folks, particularly one person on my team at the time at Third Wave. So I had this sort of massive internal uprising against me at Third Wave. What ended up happening is I ended up going and drinking ayahuasca for two straight weeks, got a little bit too involved in social media, not while directly under the influence, but in the middle of these experiences, got activated, said a few things that I shouldn't have. One thing led to a next, you know, next, and more or less the psychedelic space attempted to cancel me, which you may know, I think you're probably resonating with.
I've been on the receiving end. Yes, I have.
And it's not pretty. And so Symposia in March 2019, Symposia published a piece basically outlining how most of my team had quit. And Synthesis essentially saw this as an opportunity to say, hey, we don't want to be associated with you, right? I think it's best if we split ways. So Martijn ended up becoming CEO of Synthesis along with another one of our co-founders, Miles Katz. And essentially, I was basically cut out from that point forward. So January, 2019, I had no more involvement with Synthesis. You know, I was still a shareholder. I still owned a significant portion of the company, but they cut me out of all the day-to-day stuff. And so I was still aware. We would, you know, I was still wanting to be collaborative. Third Wave worked on a couple things with Synthesis. We supported them. But they were always very like insular, very, we don't want to collaborate, you know, like just difficult to work with in many ways. And, about a month ago, just over a month ago. So fast forwarding now, it's February 14th, Valentine's Day. And I get an email as a shareholder based from Rachel Aden, the CEO at the time, basically saying, we send this with heavy hearts. We have to declare bankruptcy. And I was astounded. Because Synthesis had raised $10 million in capital. They'd raised $10 million in capital. You assume that they would be set for potentially years. Because with a retreat business and a training business, those are not models that necessarily require a lot of upfront investment in order to make them, let's say, profitable. And so I was flabbergasted at what happened. And as I went into the finances, as I talked with a few other people, what was clear, and I had heard bubblings of this in the space. I never talked about it publicly. But what was clear is, A, the environment of the leadership team was highly toxic and was not effective. And because of that, there was an incredible mismanagement of funds. And so there was this sort of gold standard, you know, sort of mask that was worn of, we're the best. We have an incredible brand. We, you know, have the best training program. We have the best retreats. But under the surface, it was just chaos and dysfunction. And, you know, like at the end of the day, I was incredibly sad because it's sort of like having a baby. You get the baby all set. They're well prepared. They have all the investment. They have all the energy they need. You know, the brand is epic. The retreats were phenomenal. And then because of basic math and an incapacity to do management at a sort of I would say junior high level, everything fell apart. And I think the saddest part of all of this is the impact on the students. You know, they had 200 students who were going through the training program, including a couple friends of mine that I know here in California, one of whom I was hanging out with a few weeks ago when all this was going down. And she was like, yeah, they just told us that A, we can't finish your training program, and B, we can't give you your money back. So sorry, but you're out of luck. And they were just going to declare bankruptcy, go hide. And what happened is Retreat Guru, which is a SaaS, it's a software company. They, you know, Retreat Guru takes a lot. They're like the Stripe for psychedelic retreats, because a lot of psychedelic retreats can't utilize Stripe or PayPal because they're working with a Schedule One substance in the United States. So Retreat Guru just processes all the payments. So, basically Retreat Guru was like, you can't go out of business, because if you will go out of business, we're fucked, because all of these students who you didn't deliver on your promise are going to now have to ask us for refunds, and we can't handle these refunds. So more or less Retreat Guru said, we will take over all of this. They essentially now own the psychedelic practitioner training program, and they've got it back up to speed. They got the funding they needed. They have reemployed all of the facilitators. I think 90% or so of the students are still going to engage and kind of do with it. And I think this is what's so beautiful about this collaborative spirit of the psychedelic renaissance or the psychedelic movement, is there are a lot of really good people who are willing to step up even when it's difficult. And I really commend the Retreat Guru team for, in a very difficult situation, acting quick, acting fast, and acting with conviction to ensure that all of these students could actually finish the program that they were promised to finish. Now, where it goes from here, I think that's TBD, because the Synthesis brand, I think, is more or less done. So it will likely be taken over by another brand. We don't know those things yet. I think Retreat Guru is attempting to figure those out. But that is more or less the short version of Synthesis.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all that, Paul. And I do think it's incredibly felicitous that we're having this conversation today, where, just saw this news story just this morning about, okay, this other company is coming in and taking over. And, you know, it's just been this question all along of, like, who's going to be leading the facilitation training, then how much is it going to cost, and what is it going to be to actually develop a center, and what's the overhead going to be, and what's accessibility going to be. And it's interesting because we do have to deal with all of these money issues because we live in these monetary economies, and so it's just part of it. And it's an area where it's interesting that this kind of seems to be this dysfunction with Synthesis, that having raised $10 million, like, well, where does it go? And, you know, I've interviewed other people who deal with psychedelics and leadership, psychedelics and business, psychedelics and financing, and trying to bring it into the space with the idea of creating accountability and empowerment. And, you know, as you write about in your book, about getting into flow states, problem solving, creativity. But we've also got to pay attention to the nuts and bolts of how do we actually run the business, and how do we serve our clients best? And then also, how do we make it accessible outside the very wealthy? And, you know, you talk a lot in your book about all the microdosing that's been happening in Silicon Valley, which of course is big, big money. And even there, we see a lot of tech companies are like laying thousands of people off. So, and meanwhile, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk are just bathing in money, like an absurd amount of money. So it's something that needs to be talked about more and needs to be addressed. And so I'm very glad that you're here today and able to share your perspective on kind of what's gone on there and your level of involvement and also not involvement with it.
And not involvement. And the tides can turn quickly at times. You know, when this happened in 2019, when I basically was the villain of the psychedelic space for about a year or two, it's not fun. Like, it's just not fun. And, you know, I have a lot of compassion for even the team at Synthesis, particularly my co-founder Martine, and what they're going through, because it's not fun. And they made mistakes and they made poor bets and they did not run it well. But at the end of the day, I also know, having been involved with them, that they're good people and, you know, they are attempting to figure it out. Now, you know, I think the two big things, and you know, probably in the show notes or I don't know how you do this, but there's an article from Psychedelic Alpha on this. There were essentially, they bought Buckhorn Springs, which is $3.6 million. And I think that was a significant mistake, because I think Jackson County ended up voting that only psilocybin could be used in urban zones.
Right.
So they're outside the zones.
Yeah, they're outside the city limits of Ashland.
And
that was just such a bizarre vote. It's like, it's already been approved at the state level, and now we're going to give each municipality the ability to say yes or no. And, you know, there are certain pockets of, I would just say, liberal educated areas of Oregon. And there's a lot of areas of Oregon that are not well educated. I mean, even one of the arguments that people were making was, oh, people are going to come in and be growing all these mushrooms and going to use all of our water to grow all these mushrooms. It's like, do you know how to grow mushrooms? This is not using up our natural resources. We could grow enough mushrooms for the entire psilocybin therapy program in one shed, probably. You know, so just the level of misinformation and propaganda that's been spread out there. So then these municipalities got to vote on saying, no, we don't want it in our territory. So Ashland said, yes, you can do it in the city, but Jackson County, which is more rural and more conservative and less well educated on the topic, they went ahead and said no. So it's just,
Do you know the reason for that? Did you the reason they said that is because the clinical research was only done in urban zones. So they only have the clinical research on the efficacy of psilocybin in, like, you know, Johns Hopkins and NYU and all these other things. We don't know if psilocybin works in rural area. You know, it's it goes back to the education, the lack of information. We all know the power of nature connectedness with psilocybin and how actually it's so much better to be in nature than it is to be in an urban zone. And unfortunately, because of the stigmatization and lack of education, it's, you know, been totally flipped in many ways.
Yeah. And on that note, I mean, Buckhorn Springs is an ideal location for nature-centered therapeutic processing. It's in a very, very beautiful area of the Rogue Valley here in Ashland. There's beautiful oak trees, and there's grasslands, savannas, and there's creeks and rivers. I mean, it's perfect for that. And that's such an important part of the therapeutic process of reconnecting with the world and reconnecting with nature. And the idea that, no, you can only have this in a doctor's office inside city limits is so limiting, so absurd. Like the other day or the other week, I interviewed Ian Benwee from the Church of Psilocybin, and he has his practice of what he calls hyperdosing, of taking a small dose and then going on a hike and the therapeutic benefits of that. And like, yeah, I think that's a legitimate use of psilocybin therapy. But
you want to know something funny?
Yeah.
I came up with that term.
Oh, yeah.
Hyperdosing.
You're a hyperdoser. Like awesome.
3-4 years ago, I remember we started talking about it because, and this even, I mean, this is a good transition even for the book yeah. Mastering Microdosing, because it is, you know, it isn't just about the pill or it isn't just about the substance or it isn't just about the drug or the medicine. It really is the sort of synergistic relationship between what we're doing. And it's not either or, you know, it's either we're not doing psychedelics at all, or we're doing 5-MeO-DMT and, you know, connecting with the unity and oneness of everything. There's a million shades of gray in between. And yeah. I think this speaks to the importance of a nuanced approach that is really rooted in both scientific fact, right, and sort of objective research, but also in lineage and tradition and ritual of how we've been using these for thousands and thousands of years. And to me, that marriage between the sort of ancient and modern is what this third wave of psychedelics is all about, that we don't have to choose. It isn't either or, but we really have to figure out the integrative process to both have, you know, approaches with psychedelics that are informed by science and informed by research and informed by protocols and best practices. And just as important are the rituals and, you know, the indigenous sort of animistic traditions that really psychedelic experiences cannot be, you can't take them out of that context. You know, even if we have all this clinical research and even if we're doing our best to sort of, I would say, whitewash these substances, the fundamental truth is they cannot be undone from this animistic, indigenous, you know, really a primordial feeling that we often have with them.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is a perfect transition to really talk about what's in the book. And I will say, having read through it, it's very, very thorough. You cover a lot of different topics, and it's in a very friendly format, very reader-friendly, and you've got the QR codes in there. You want to learn more and take you back to the website. And it really kind of goes through, point by point, so many issues around microdosing, from the science to how to go about doing it, how to prepare it, emphasis on coaching and intention around use of it, and then all the possible applications. And I will say, I haven't read Fadiman's book about it, so I can't compare it.
Well,
to
he
that.
Just had a chapter, right? So the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide was the chapter 16 was about microdosing, but that was it. And so this is really, and it's the third edition. I published the first edition in 2016, the second edition in 2018, and then I hired a professional team to really come in and make this something that I actually want to promote and get out there. And it's really the first major, probably the second major book on microdosing. The first one was Ilette Waldman, who wrote A Really Good Day, which was about her use of microdosing LSD in sort of a diary format. But this is really, you know, I tell my story in it, but it's really focused on the pragmatic, practical aspect of microdosing. Like, you know, how much is a microdose? What's the difference between LSD and psilocybin? What are the different protocols? What do we combine microdosing with? What do we know about some of the neuroplastic benefits or the sort of benefits for the gut or overall holistic health? So I really try to do, I love broad landscapes. That's how I even approach the psychedelic space. I'm not just psilocybin or 5-MeO or MDMA, or I'm not just therapy, or, you know, I really look at what is the broadest landscape possible, and how do we contextualize that broad landscape for a mainstream audience so they can develop the necessary psychedelic literacy to be informed then about decisions that are being made as it relates to the legalization or decriminalization of these medicines?
Yeah, well, then I would say that you've accomplished that quite nicely in the book, because it's definitely a book that I think anyone could be comfortable giving to someone who's like, so what is this psychedelic microdosing? What is this about? Or is somebody who doesn't know anything about it, it's a great starting point. And then people who want to go deeper into their own microdosing regimen and look at it from different angles. And, you know, even dealing with the question of placebo versus quantifiable effects. That's been something of a debate in the psychedelic world about what is microdosing really accomplishing. And you also distinguish it between the museum dose and then the large dose, you know, for the more quote unquote mystical states of consciousness that are used in other therapeutic settings. So it really just covers a broad range of topics, and it's all done in a very reader accessible way, and it feels very, very comprehensive.
Thank you, Martin. Yeah. And I think a couple things that you touch on there. One is the placebo. I think that's a good starting point. Placebo versus microdosing, because there was a lot of enthusiasm about microdosing in the early days. So as I mentioned prior, Jim Fadiman was on the Tim Ferriss podcast in 2015, right? He published the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, I think, in 2011 on the podcast in 2015. Rolling Stone writes a piece about Silicon Valley utilizing microdosing. And then all of a sudden, it takes off like wildfire. But the first clinical research on microdosing, I don't think was published until 2019 or even 2020. And it was very much like a dose response, a physiological dose response curve out of the University of Chicago by Harriet DeWitt. The vast majority of research that has come out around microdosing is not experimental research. It is observational research. So it's essentially survey-based. It's asking people to sort of talk about their subjective experience. There's not a lot of objectivity that's been brought to microdosing. And I think what that has unfortunately led to is a lot of people, especially over the last couple of years, have discounted microdosing because they're like, oh no, this is just placebo effect and that's it. And I think that comes down to, I would say, that boils down to, let's say, two main things. The first thing that's important to emphasize is that the definition of a microdose, a lot of people aren't necessarily clear on. Mm-hmm. So people who are microdosing, right, the first definition that came out around it was when Dr. Fadiman called it a subperceptual dose, which is actually in the subtitle of this book.
Right.
And that meaning, you know, you take a microdose, but you don't feel anything at all. Right. Now, Dr. Fadiman has said publicly that he may have made a mistake by defining microdosing in that particular of a way. And so the new sort of definition, and I will update the title to reflect this for future editions of the book, I think comes from Paul Stamets. I was interviewing Paul Stamets for our podcast several months ago at Wonderland, and he said, a microdose is not subperceptual. It is subintoxicating. Hmm. So it's a dose level that you take where you can still navigate your everyday life. You know, you're not intoxicated to the point where you're having visuals or can't do your sort of normal everyday activities. And I love that way more because it allows for space for, oh, I can feel a little euphoric, or I can feel a heightened mood, or I can notice sort of an enhanced sense of smell or touch, or I notice just my heart's more open. I think a lot of people were getting so attached to this definition of microdosing as subperceptual and you can't feel it, that then of course they're going to think it's just a placebo because it's almost homeopathic at that point. And I think the reframe around subintoxicating rather than subperceptual and being a bit more flexible with that definition should ideally then inform a lot of the research that's been being done, because I think from that context, we'll actually find greater efficacy for these low doses of psychedelics.
Okay. Well, I think that is a wonderful point of clarification, because I haven't been up on the debate around microdosing or the terminology that's being used. And so I will admit that that's kind of how I thought of it. It's like, well, are people just talking about homeopathic doses of mushrooms and then talking about how great their day was? Because I tend to be very sensitive to psychedelics. So if I even just eat like a little capsule of mushrooms, like I notice it. So I've thought, okay, so I guess this isn't microdosing, because I am, you know, things are brighter. I'm feeling different energies in my body. I notice those sensations, and I know that that's the mushroom. So I guess this isn't a microdose. It wouldn't qualify. But by the definition that you're giving, it would fit within that category. That we're not going for the, okay, geometry everywhere. Oh, look, endless fractals. And oh, here I go. We're not looking for that, but we're talking about below that. And also below what you call the museum dose, which I think is a great term, of the idea of when you would take a small dose. I think you describe it as around like a gram of, say, psilocybin mushrooms, where you're definitely going to be getting visual effects from that. And it's going to be more than just a little bit. So you don't necessarily want to be too social at that point, but like going and looking at art would be great, you know?
Or going to a concert.
Yeah.
And experiencing music, yeah. Right? Yeah. So that's about like a gram of psilocybin mushrooms, or what I call about 50 micrograms of LSD. A microdose of LSD is, you know, it could be anywhere from 5 micrograms to even 30 micrograms of LSD, depending on the person, because our neurology, our physiology, our age, our sort of neuroticism, all of that plays a role in terms of our sensitivity to psychedelics. The other interesting part about, I think, the placebo versus microdosing conversation is how these research trials are being set up. And there's two core, I would say, problems or issues right now with how they're being set up that I think are important to address for this podcast. One is, you know, with psychedelic assisted psychotherapy and the clinical research that's been carried out at NYU and Johns Hopkins and Imperial College and these other places, it's very clear that the efficacy of these trials and the efficacy of these medicines is not only because of the drug, but it's also because of the therapeutic support.
Right.
People who are helping with assessment, preparation, the experience itself, and then integration, right? I think the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy protocol for MAPS is like 3 sessions in 12 weeks with support that entire journey to show the efficacy. What's happening in the microdosing trials that are being set up is they're just saying, well, let's just see what happens when they take a pill. We're not going to necessarily provide them with any therapeutic support or any coaching. We're just really looking at the substance itself, which I think is a huge mistake. When because in a way we've been here before in the 60s, although psychedelic assisted psychotherapy was the predominant form of research carried on in psychedelics, there was also a form called psycholytic therapy. Mm-hmm. And psycholytic therapy was taking a small dose of a psychedelic 1 to 2 times a week as part of a normal therapeutic process. And what they found is the efficacy of the psycholytic therapy was actually just as great as the efficacy of the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. And so when we're looking at the clinical research and the research that's being carried out on microdosing, I think it's critically important that we mimic what we've done with high doses to ensure that people who are going through with these sort of microdosing clinical trials have preparation support, have integration support. They have someone who is coaching them or, you know, providing therapeutic support for them throughout that entire process. And I think the, you know, outside of just sort of keeping parallel tracks to measure efficacy, I think the other reason for that is because it mimics sort of a naturalistic setting. And what they found in microdosing research, there's this really interesting research done in New Zealand last year by a company called Mind Biotherapeutics. And it was supported by a researcher named Suresh Muthukumarsi or something like that. His last name is literally like 30 letters long. It's totally insane. And Suresh carried out a phase 1 clinical trial on 10 micrograms of LSD for Mind Biotherapeutics in New Zealand. And because New Zealand is a small country, it's like 4 to 5 million people. The government approved as part of that trial for the subjects to take the LSD home with them and microdose in a naturalistic setting. And what Suresh found was that was actually the key distinct variable of efficacy. That when people are microdosing in a non-natural setting, in a hospital bed or in a sort of neutral room or a place that's just sort of boring, there's nothing going on, that there isn't a lot of efficacy because even at a microdose, we're still sensitive to set and setting and our overall environment. But that when they were allowed to take it home with them and go hiking and go for a walk and connect with a loved one and do their natural, normal things, there was actually much greater efficacy for that microdose of LSD.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense, given that, especially when we're dealing with these lower levels, it's always possible for the individual to kind of clamp down and resist whatever might be changing within them during that experience. And, you know, so sometimes people talk about how, you know, they're tripping really hard, but then the phone rings and they're like, oh, I want to answer the phone. So then Everything goes down. They talk on the phone, then hang up. So if you're just in the doctor's office and the people are asking you, so how are you feeling? How are you feeling? There's going to be that inhibition that's kind of built in. But once you get back into your natural environment, that's when you can see, oh, actually, I'm approaching this in a different way. That it has to be something that is familiar at that routine level. Because, of course, depression, anxiety, impacts of trauma, these are things that get us in our normal everyday activities, right? As we're just trying to go about our day. Or issues of creativity, problem solving, that's when we're at work, when we're doing the things that we're engaged in. So getting people that opportunity to be engaged in the normal activities, that seems like, as you say, a far better assessment of what you're actually feeling and what results you might be getting from it than if you're just sitting in a doctor's office and I could just imagine like the doctor's asking you like, sir, you feel more creative now? I don't know. Right. You know, but if you're working on something, then you see the effects and you feel it. Like I noticed in one of the stories that was recounted in Mastery Microdosing, you talked about how a person who was writing said that they could feel how their thoughts were transforming into their fingers and as they're actually writing and kind of feeling that flow state. But you have to be engaged in your normal activities to notice that difference. If you're just sitting there, not doing anything, just being asked questions, it's not going to elicit those kinds of responses.
And that's a huge part as well. So there, I mentioned the LSD clinical research in New Zealand. Paul Stamets also published sort of, it was more observational research than experimental research, but he used an app by Quantified Citizen where you had people self-report. And he had like 7,000 people go through this, again, mostly with psilocybin, but in a naturalistic setting. And this was published, I think he has published two research papers now about the efficacy of microdosing that they've discovered through this in Nature, which is one of the more premier scientific journals. And similar results as what they found in these sort of clinical trials. And so I think if there are any researchers listening to this, or just broadly speaking, it's so critically important from an integrity, more than anything else, an integrity perspective, that we do research on microdosing in naturalistic settings that is actually personalized to the individual. Because I think the final caveat here that we briefly touched on but is worth revisiting is every single person has a different subjective experience with these psychedelics. You mentioned you're very sensitive. I used to be less sensitive, and then as I've sort of worked more with psychedelics, I've become more sensitive to it. So for me, a microdose is at the most 10 micrograms. I can probably do actually between 6 and 7 and feel quite good for where I'm at, whereas it used to be like 20 micrograms. But for someone who's like in their 70s and, you know, has a history of SSRI use, they might need 40 micrograms or 50 micrograms for it to be a true microdose. And I think that lack of personalization is also responsible for a lack of efficacy as it shows in the results. So sort of my ideal utopia for microdosing research is let's use things like the Oura Ring and EEG scans and blood draws and, you know, psychometrics that we do at home. Let's use that in combination with a coach who can help you ensure that you've landed the dose level that's appropriate for you and measure the efficacy that way, rather than attempting to fit people into this sort of box. You're going to do 10 micrograms. Yeah. You're going to take it at 8 a.m. You're going to report at this time. It's very machine-like, and it's not reflective of how people are actually working with these medicines.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that all of that also applies at the macro dose.
Absolutely. End,
because I mean, this is a question that people ask me all the time, usually in regards to 5-MeO. They're asking like, well, what's the best ideal dose for a full release? And it's like, look, it's different for different people, and it's different for the same person at different times, depending on where they are at in that very moment. And so there are no magic numbers. And then also people come to me with saying, well, the person next to me was not freaking out on my ayahuasca dose and they were able to go home, and then I'm still tripping. What's going on? We're getting the same dose. Shouldn't we be getting standardized results? And the same thing with mushrooms and really any psychedelic, that there's so much variability there that we can't really just generically say what the proper dose for anyone is in any particular set or setting, that it takes a much more individualized approach. And I would say this is a somewhat different topic, but someone was just asking me about this a little bit earlier today about optimizing integration protocols for 5-MeO-DMT. And my answer there was that it really needs to be individualized, that you need to understand that person, their history, what they're bringing to their experience, what happened to their experience, and also what are the effects that they're getting afterwards, and then tailoring the advice that is given for that person by looking at that entire process. But if we just hand somebody a generic sheet saying, okay, you've had this experience, do these things to integrate, doesn't really help that much. And it's the same thing with dosing. Like, oh, you want to achieve these effects? Here's your dosing protocol. And that also, I think you talk about this in the book, that it's worthwhile to experiment, to try out different things on yourself. If you're doing a microdosing protocol, find what works for you, find what levels work for you. And maybe you can fine tune, okay, this is the microdose I want to have for dancing. This is the one I want to have if I'm going to work, you know, looking at those things and understanding yourself as the integrated system that you are, and that it's not, we're not dealing with mechanical issues, that we can't just say, oh, you've got this problem, this dosage, that's going to fix it for you, or that's going to be right, because it's not the case.
It doesn't work. I mean, this is why healthcare is a mess right now, is because it's all happened within the sort of set and setting of industrialism, which has treated humans like machines. And so that whole physicalist kind of metaphysic lens is, I think, what is destroying us as a species in many ways. And I think that is the one of the greatest potentials of psychedelics, is to actually help us pop out of this sort of physicalist reductionist mindset and step into one that sees the importance of not only consciousness, but the soul, and how we are these sort of unique snowflakes, if you will. And when it comes then to psychedelics, how kind of what you're talking about as it relates to microdosing is the importance of calibration. And, you know, we have a training program for coaches now. We train, it's interesting. A lot of the programs in the space are focused on the therapeutic use. So, you know, they'll train therapists, they train medical doctors, they train other medical professionals, clinical psychologists, social workers, et cetera, et cetera. Our training program, we speak a lot to like executive coaches, performance coaches, health and wellness coaches, life coaches, relationship coaches, more that lens and that realm. And one thing I always emphasize, it's like kind of my main mantra in the training program, is there are no prescriptions. Mm. We are not machines. Everything requires a human touch.
Yeah.
Right? Everything requires a human touch. And so that process of calibration, it even plays into this whole context of psychedelics as a skill. Right? You don't learn how to cook by reading a cookbook. You don't learn how to write by reading a book on writing. You don't learn how to do jujitsu by, you know, watching a documentary on jujitsu. You learn these things by doing them.
Yeah.
You learn cooking by cooking. You learn jujitsu by showing up at the dojo, and you learn how to write by putting pen to paper. And you learn how to work with psychedelics by cultivating a relationship with the medicine, right? With psilocybin, with LSD, with, you know, whatever else it might be. And I think one of the reasons microdosing then is so appealing is because there's not as much of a, I would even call it like a trade-off. A lot of people are intimidated, for example, by 5-MeO-DMT because of the intensity of it. And oftentimes the way that I coach people, it's like, don't start with 5-MeO. You know, start with a microdose, start with a lower dose, start getting a sense of how this feels, what the subjective experience is, sort of get your swimmies on and feel into the sort of shallow end of consciousness before you kind of jump off the diving board and swim in the deep end of consciousness. And calibration is part of that. Learning from a hands-on trial and error experimental approach is so necessary to that, for all these reasons that we're talking about, because the way that 20 micrograms of LSD impacts me is going to be different than you, is going to be different than her, is going to be different than him. And so ensuring that we have a clear sense of, oh, if I take 100 milligrams of psilocybin, you know, this is how I'm going to feel. Or if I take 300 milligrams of psilocybin with reishi, lion's mane, ashwagandha, and damayana, this is how I'm going to feel. Or if I take a microdose of LSD and go hiking, well, probably I want to take 30 micrograms of LSD because it's slightly euphoric. I have more energy, but I can still, you know, maybe drive my car to and from the hike if I really need to. You know, like that lens and that context, I think, is so necessary for our culture to develop, because it really allows us to go from we're like in the stone age of psychedelic literacy right now, right? It feels like we're like in the dark ages of consciousness at this point in time. And what psychedelics are doing is they're illuminating a path forward where we can actually step into the true psychedelic renaissance.
Nice. So let's talk a little bit about this distinction in terms of coaching and therapists and micro and macro doses. So, we've talked about it a couple times already, but the idea usually around the therapeutic side, you know, when we're dealing with, like, for example, psilocybin assisted therapy, the idea is that patients are going to be taking a fairly large dose of a macro dose, and that there, you know, places like John Hopkins, they've found that a lot of the transformative potential within the psychedelic experience seems to center around the mystical experience. And that can be described in lots of different ways, and we have lots of different determiners of that. And microdosing is not that. And so it doesn't require the same level of necessary therapeutic attention, but you do talk a lot about using a microdose coach to help set intention and help guide you. Because going back to this idea that this is all psychedelics are a non-specific amplifier. So the way that I like to put it is that, look, it's going to impact your energetic experience of being. Now, that means your thoughts, your emotions, your sensations, your bodily sense of being and beyond, that it can impact any of these areas. So how does this approach with a coach and microdosing, how is that different than just the big mystical breakthrough? And also, I would invite, maybe the crossover point would be this notion of flow states, which are also an aspect of mystical experience, but seems to be accessible through lower order experiences, such as through microdosing. So that's kind of a handful. Pick it up where you like.
So the skill of psychedelics, since I've talked about it already, I think I'll sort of root in that. And when I look at the skill of psychedelics, I'm really looking at what is the overlap between high doses, these sort of breakthrough mystical, you know, non-dual experiences, microdoses, which we're working with a small amount of the substance as sort of an amplifier or an enhancer, but then also non-psychedelic modalities, right? Meditation, breath work, yoga, our lifestyle, diet, exercise, sleep. There's a lot of modalities that still help us to stay grounded, to sort of calm our autonomic nervous system, to help us be present, to help us be connected. And so when I look at how we cultivate that skill of psychedelics, I'm really looking at sort of an overlap of those three, where I think what these therapeutic macrodoses are really good for are setting a new North Star, right? Oftentimes when people work with, whether it's 5-MeO-DMT or 5 grams of mushrooms or ayahuasca, time and time again, they talk about how, for the first time in my life, I've experienced unconditional love.
Yeah.
Right? Unconditional love, because I had incredible parenting. I love my parents a lot. They had their issues and challenges, of course, but they were always there. They were supportive. They're still together. They went to all my, you know, soccer games and violin recitals and parent-teacher conferences and, like, super present, super supportive, and still their love was conditional.
Yeah.
Right?
It's how humans tend to do it.
It's how humans are. And this is the importance of I wouldn't go so far as to say religion, because religion has dogmatism and all that, but spirituality, connection to the mystery, connection to God, connection to source, is that actual felt embodied experience of unconditional love. And absolutely, oftentimes when people have that for the first time, there's a natural therapeutic process, because all these parts of themselves, these shadow parts, these unconscious parts, a light is shining there, and it's both illuminating and awakening, and sometimes very challenging, because they're confronted with truths that they have kept kind of like, oh, handle this later, thank you very much, you know? And so that illuminating, you know, with a macrodose, it's often going to be therapeutic. So the microdose or lower doses, I find, are often better from a coaching lens and a coaching perspective, because there's still an ability to stay present, to be with, to be in the here and now, and to utilize microdosing as an amplifier, as an enhancer, as I would even call sort of a lubricant, And the reason I use that word lubricant is because of the neuroplastic benefits of even low doses of psychedelics that make it easier for us to sort of adapt and change and shift on a day-to-day basis. Because so oftentimes when the ego becomes ruminative, when it becomes sort of too ingrained in its normal everyday structure, we're not as willing to be open and adaptable to change. And so these lower doses really allow us to be a little bit more adaptable, a little bit more flexible, which is great from a coaching lens and a coaching perspective. Now, the other, not reframe, but the other context that I think is important here is I often look at the therapeutic process as being more focused on the past, more focused on how do we heal the stories, how do we heal the narrative of what has happened to us, what has happened prior, what emotions, what stories have been imprinted on the subconscious and the unconscious. What past lives might we need to sort of explore and understand for us to feel whole now? So I think there's another element where the therapeutic process tends to be more, okay, let's heal what's happened before. Whereas the coaching process is more, what are we going to create? What is it that we're inspired to build in the world? Who is it that we're inspired to create and build with? And so oftentimes a macrodose experience for people who are brand new to psychedelics, it almost always has a therapeutic lens is what I found. Even if we had people who came to Synthesis who were like, yeah, well, you know, I've been semi-retired for 5 years. I want to figure out what I'm going to do next. And they would come in and they would have this high dose experience with psilocybin. And even though that was their intention, the actual teaching was, I actually need to spend more time with my spouse and my kids. And I actually need to do a lot more sort of repairing of my relationships. And once that's addressed, then maybe I can go and sort of address these other creative things. But I find a lot of times that mystical experience, that high dose experience is almost always therapeutic initially. And once that shadow material has sort of been illuminated, there's a catharsis, there's a transmutation of what lies in the shadow, I think then people have the capacity to really step into that full sort of not only self-actualization, but self-transcendence capacity with psychedelics. Because I think the greatest potential for the cultural use of psychedelics is not necessarily fixing what's broken. You know, there's this sort of common trope in the psychedelic space, which is psychedelics are going to fix our healthcare system. Let's pharmaceuticalize psychedelics. Let's make sure they're great for depression and addiction and PTSD. And this isn't to overstate the importance of healing, because it can't be overstated. A lot of people are suffering tremendously and psychedelics are helping them. And Buckminster Fuller would often say, don't try to fix something that's broken, right? Don't try to fix a broken system. Build a new system, build a new model that makes the old model obsolete. And so when I talk about this sort of psychedelic renaissance, my sense is the greatest potential of this third wave of psychedelics is how do we develop a new paradigm that recognizes the truth of interconnectedness, that recognizes how everything is interconnected, that everything is related, and that there are no externalities, right? That separation is an illusion. And how do we build a paradigm that's rooted in those fundamental truths of this mystical experience, almost re-spiritualizing our entire cultural paradigm and system.
Yeah. And I think another way that we can make some comparisons and distinctions here is that it seems like the breakthrough mystical experience, as you say, it tends to deal with people's life history reaching up to that point and then a release of whatever patterns were trapping them. And so as people have that experience, it's very common for people to report having a grace period afterwards where you're just like, wow, I'm really in flow. Things feel good. I'm not trapped by my old patterns. But a common thing that then arises later for people that I've noticed in my own consultations is that people ask then, so how do I apply this now to my life? So there's the breakthrough release, which is very, very transformative, very powerful. But then it comes back to this issue sort of performance, of how do I perform differently within my life? As you say, like repairing relationships. And so here, microdosing, I think, seems to be more on the performance end of looking at how am I performing in normal 3D reality outside of a massive breakthrough, but also potentiating the possibility of entering into a flow state through the catalyst of the microdose, which the flow state is kind of a nice medium range between the egoically trapped individuated individual and then the mystical absorption into the non-dual. Is okay, I'm still a player in the game, but there's no resistance. And there's a sense of flow, there's a sense of connection, and there's a sense of intuitive immediacy to the actions that are taking place. So it's not absorbed into the all, but it's also not completely trapped within the individual. It's in this in-between state. And so I think it's very interesting to look at microdosing as an access point into these very, very wonderful states. And, you know, sometimes people have a hard time who haven't had a flow state, like understanding what it can be. But it's something that shows up for musicians. It's something that shows up for athletes. It shows up for, you know, people who are in various performative roles where you're doing something and it just, the words come, the actions come, and there's no thought behind it. And it's just, it's a really delicious state to be in. And sometimes afterwards, for individuals who experience that, they look back on it and they're like, I don't know how I did that, you know?
And what I love about that is what I have in here is flow is the middle way. I love Taoism and the Tao Te Ching and kind of looking at that's a lot of my philosophy, even through third wave. It's like, what?
Yeah.
I always come back to what is the middle way, right? What is the middle way? And I think flow is that middle way. Even as we're having this conversation, I'm finding myself when I sort of go off on these monologues in a flow state.
Yeah.
Where when I get up on stage, I feel like I'm in a flow state, right? Where I kind of have a sense of the structure because flow needs some level of structure. There's a challenge at place. It's not necessarily boring. It's really getting me to step up and be vital and be alive. And it's something I'm pretty good at already. And I think that's also important for flow. It's not like, you know, if you've never gone snowboarding and you go out on the hill and you try to snowboard, you're going to be able to access flow right away. No, you kind of got to have that basic foundation. And then boom, you drop a microdose in there, 20 mics of LSD, you know, 350 milligrams of psilocybin, and the no mind state comes in. There's an absorption with the present moment, and it's like a muse is just flowing through you, is what it feels like. Like you said, there's no thinking, there's no rumination, it's just coming. And what they found with research on flow, it's very similar to this mystical experience where, you know, Johns Hopkins, psilocybin occasions a mystical experience. Those who have these more powerful mystical experience have sort of longer lasting benefits from the psilocybin. It's the same thing with flow. Those who are in flow more often are generally happier people. They generally find more meaning in life. They generally have higher levels of contentment. And that teaching, I think, is what microdosing is so powerful for. And I'm grateful that you've brought us back to that a couple times now, right? Because that remembrance that state exists and that microdosing, just like high doses are a replicable way to experience a mystical experience, I think microdosing is a replicable way to experience flow more often. And so that intention behind it, you know, the structure, the slight challenge, when you put a microdose in, then it's like, all right, game's on, let's do this.
Yeah, and I love that you mentioned that flow is often associated, or at least built upon the foundation of lots and lots of practice initially. Because it's one that can be hard for people to understand. Like you mentioned Taoism, and so there's this wonderful concept that I'm sure you're familiar with of Wu Wei, which is usually translated as actionless action. And this can be really befuddling. Like, so how do I engage in actionless action? And here, you know, the Taoist approach was, well, you train and train and train and train. And then through that training, so for example, Tai Chi, Qigong, you're doing these mind-body exercises and you're training where you're given, here are the specific forms and you're doing it. But then once you learn those forms, that, as you say, the flow state has to have some form of structure to work within. That if there are no boundaries, then there's no place for the flow state to exist within, that it needs a course to go through. So the training provides the structure, and then you can break through into that flow state. Like, and also with musicians, that musicians go into flow states, but they practice a hell of a lot. That, like, no one just picks up an instrument and all of a sudden, you know, they do it. It's the training that allows for the flow state to take place. And that's, again, where I think it's interesting, this idea of microdosing as focusing on practical application of practice. How am I entering into the events that I'm engaged in? Where is my focus? Where is my center? How am I embodying myself through this experience? And so the microdosing helps highlight all of these things so that we can see the structures that we're working within and then have that state of flow. So it's not just the microdose, it's also how we are practicing as individuals and where we are applying ourselves. And then, yeah, we get that nice middle road. And, you know, for me, it just reminds me of where I just started breaking into these flow states at not a macro dose, but a little bit more than a museum dose of mushrooms at Burning Man and walking and found myself, I'd done some practicing of Tai Chi. But I'm walking around Burning Man and I'm like doing all these Tai Chi movements, and that's how I was getting from one place to another. And it was just, it was so awesome. I wasn't even thinking about what I was doing. It's just, yeah, I'm going to go over here. So I would like literally flow from one place to the next. And actually at one point I realized, I don't know how long they were there, but a whole bus, this giant art car was actually following me around the playa. They were letting me lead them. And I turned around and like the people driving the car, they're all waving at me. Yeah. It's like, okay. And that, and that broke my flow because all of a sudden their self-conscious is like, oh, people are watching me do this.
Right. Right. Oh, I love it. Burning Man is like one peak experience. I mean, it is, it almost feels like one flow state oftentimes when you're, when you're there, and it's beautiful. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. So one thing that I think it's come up a little bit, but let's maybe get back into this, is making the distinction between different modalities of microdosing. So here I have not read Paul Stamets' articles, but my understanding is that he's kind of looking at microdosing in combination with other mushroom elements, non-psychedelic mushrooms such as lion manes and things like that, as sort of a bio-optimizing of looking at, am I getting the nutrients that I need in order to be bio-optimized? I don't know if you would describe that as a correct interpretation of his approach, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that is and how that might be different than other applications of microdosing.
So there's really two core protocols that have become well-known. One is James Fadiman, right, where he talked about one day on, 2 days off, because there's a 48-hour window of tolerance for these serotonergic agonists or whatever they are. And so if you take it on day one, you're going to have some good vibes. Day two, there's this afterglow. Day three, you're back to baseline, and then repeat. And Fadiman's initial protocol, what he recommends was do that for 5 weeks. So do it two times a week for about 5 weeks, 10 microdosing cycles in total, and then stop, assess how your baseline has shifted, and go from there. Paul Stamets came out, I think it was like 2016 or 2017. He was on the Joe Rogan podcast and talked about microdosing. And he initially said 5 days on, 2 days off. And that's now shifted to 4 days on, 3 days off. And really looking at the combination, as you mentioned, of psilocybin, lion's mane, and niacin. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, he finally, after years and years of trying, got approved by the patent office for that combination. So now he has a patent on the combination of psilocybin, lion's mane, and niacin as a supplement. And he's really looking at it as, let's say, a supplement for neuroplasticity, right? A supplement to help connect and create new connections in the brain. And his argument is that psilocybin by itself does it, lion's mane by itself does it, and niacin by itself is a vasodilator. But when you combine the three, the synergistic impact is something that each individual component cannot do. And the parallel he draws is to gunpowder, right? The reason gunpowder could become quote unquote patented is because it's a combination of three natural ingredients or whatever, four, I don't know how many. And the combination of those creates something novel and new. And so that's sort of his approach with microdosing. And what I will say about those protocols is protocols like this are helpful to build an initial scaffolding. Right. So for those who are new to microdosing or those who are new to psychedelics, I think it's imperative that they do follow a protocol that's been tried and tested that a lot of people know about. There's another protocol like one day on, one day off, one day on, one day off that some people work with as well. My recommendation for LSD is to never do it more than twice a week. because it is more stimulating, more dopaminergic than psilocybin. Psilocybin, it's not quite as activating. So sometimes people do it 3 times a week, which I think works. But to follow a scaffolding, to follow a protocol to build that scaffolding. And then I think what lies beyond that is what we've already touched on a little bit, which is intuition. So now when I microdose, it's like, well, what do I have going on today? Like, for example, right after this conversation, a body worker is going to come over. I'm going to do some like structural integration for like a 7-hour session or something ridiculous. So what I'm doing is I'm taking a chocolate, a mushroom chocolate that has ghost psilocybin. So ghost is a type of psilocybin strain. It has kana, which is a heart opener, theobromine, which is a heart opener, lion's mane, which is a functional mushroom, and then damiana, which is an aphrodisiac. And I'm taking that in combination with the body work because I know myself well enough to know that it's going to help me with sort of softening and releasing when I need to.
Yeah.
Other people might, you know, when it comes to intuition, say, hey, I have a hike with a friend later on and I want to take 20 micrograms of LSD for it. Or, hey, I'm not feeling the best today. My energy and mood is pretty low. I think I might need a microdose of psilocybin just to help, you know, help kind of bump me up for the day, if you will. So the scaffolding initially is helpful, but I think at the end of the day, it's a lot about listening. It's a lot about intuition and just getting a sense of a feeler of, okay, this is my intention for the day. What dose level might help facilitate that intention that I have?
Yeah. So these sounds like questions that someone who goes through the coaching program, perhaps they'd be able to give advice on this. So maybe we could shift into talking about, so this is when we go to thethirdwave.co, we've got various resources. We've got guides, resources, providers, and courses listed up here. And we have the coaching certificate program and personalized psychedelic coaching. And we've talked a little bit about this, that the coach is different than the therapist. They're coming at it from a different angle. So how does the program work? And then how does the application of actually working with a coach, what are they doing for people and helping with developing their scaffolding and also probably helping them develop their intuitive appreciation of what's going to work for them?
So we developed the training program about 2 years ago. March 2021 was when I had the idea. We had our first cohort in June 2021. We've trained at this point about, I think 100 coaches have completed the program, and we'll have about another 120 who complete it this year. And it's a 6-month program, 3 months of what I call theory. So lectures and workshops that are about the skill of psychedelics. We have a 6-day intensive, otherwise called a retreat in Costa Rica, where psilocybin is decriminalized. So we do a high dose psilocybin ceremony. We do a hiker dose with the group. We do breath work. We do cold plunge. We do, you know, a few other, you know, we have workshops and things like that as part of that 6-day intensive. And then there's a 3-month practicum on the back end to actually start to, how do I apply this within a coaching practice potentially? Most of the people who apply, most of the people who join the program are established coaches. They already have a coaching practice. We're not necessarily training coaches. We're not training people on how to become a coach. Right. We're training coaches on how to work with psychedelics as another modality, as another tool in their toolkit. And the core frame that we use for that is what we currently refer to as Third Wave's model of transformation. And right now that model, I would say, is very much in an MVP stage. It's very much a V1. Most of the models or the frameworks in the psychedelic space are about the therapeutic applications of psychedelics. So, you know, the CAP model or MDMA-assisted psychotherapy model or the psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy model, these are all therapeutic. And so what we are creating is really a new model that looks at the overlap of psychedelics and the betterment of the well, or psychedelics and transformation, or psychedelics and, you know, leadership, creativity, and flow, whatever frame you want to put on it. And so what we do is we train our coaches then in understanding that model. And there are 5 parts to that model. Awareness: how do psychedelics help facilitate greater awareness? Self-regulation: how can psychedelics help us to better regulate from a physiological perspective our autonomic nervous system? Motivation: how do psychedelics help us to find what inspires us, what motivates us to get up every day? Interpersonal: how can psychedelics help us to create social bonds and connections so the things that we want to do and create in the world we can do with other people and community? And then what we call the collective: what is sort of the larger vision of what is happening and what is going on? And how do we steward that larger collective energy for the betterment of all? And so we bring in that model. We talk about, you know, the sort of scientific research. We talk about rituals or indigenous practices around those things. And then that's the scaffolding for our personalized psychedelic coaching program. So the sort of top coaches that graduate from our coaching program are now coaching kind of our broader public, our broader community. Those who are not necessarily coaches but want to have a high dose experience, you know, they want to be coached through microdosing, et cetera, et cetera. So again, the frame that we have on that is that that's a 9-week program, more or less. And we're coaching people through what I would call a breakthrough experience. So it's 4 weeks of preparation, a high dose psychedelic experience, which is usually psilocybin, ketamine, because it's legal. We grow we sell a mushroom grow kit through Third Wave. So if you go on Third Wave, you can buy a grow kit. You have to buy the spores yourself, but we're trying to make it as easy as possible for people to grow their own mushrooms to ensure accessibility remains super high for all of this. Ketamine, or some people, if they can, they might source MDMA or, you know, yeah, we don't really touch on 5-MeO or ayahuasca. That's a little, I think, too advanced for a virtual coaching program. So 4 weeks of prep, the breakthrough experience, and then 4 weeks of coaching with microdosing. And so we coach clients then through that process of microdosing for sort of a 9-week trajectory. And again, the focus being not so much on the therapeutic process. So everyone has to go through a screening. We have an assessment. We have to tell some people no, just because our coaches are not necessarily equipped to handle deep trauma, because that does come up. And then the focus is really on, you know, we have a relationship coach. We have what we call a creativity coach, a leadership coach, an embodiment coach, and a health and well-being coach. And so based on the intention, so let's say someone comes in and they're like, you know, my relationship has been off lately. I'm really struggling with my partner. Then they might choose to work with the relationship coach. Or let's say someone comes in and they're like, I really want to make some significant changes to my diet and my overall lifestyle. Then they'll work with our health and well-being coach. Or if someone comes in and says, I'm in a leadership position and I think psychedelics could be tremendously helpful at, you know, empathy and connection and overall vision, then we pair them with our leadership coach. And so there's that capacity to personalize then the experience based on the intention of what someone is coming in for.
Yeah. So something that I was a little bit surprised to hear, but I'm actually very happy to hear, is that you're including a breakthrough dose experience within the training program. Because I think that that's always an interesting question that sometimes I've talked to people who have only microdosed mushrooms, and then, you know, and talking to them, it's like, well, I don't think you really know what mushrooms can really do. So I would encourage you to go for a larger dose, but I'd like to hear that you're including that breakthrough dose so that you can understand maybe the fullest potential. And then, okay, so let's talk about what it really means to, as you say, put on the swimmies and go for, you know, these smaller doses and these smaller applications, but also know the potential. And I think it's so important because, as we've also talked about, that you can get someone who's extremely sensitive and you think you're giving them a little microdose, but all of a sudden they're going into some kind of full mystical state or something. I mean, it doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And so I think it's so important for the coach to at least have some personal experience there so they can relate to it, rather than saying, well, it doesn't do that for me, or that we're not trying for that.
And that's what we tell our coaches. It's like, before you ever advise or recommend or facilitate any type of experience for someone, you need to have walked that territory yourself, right? And I think what's important to emphasize here is the training program is not for guides. We're not training people on how to guide high-dose psychedelic experiences. We're training coaches on how to assess, prepare, and integrate. And naturally, like, as part of the cohorts, we have guides who come and they join the community. And so what ends up happening is there's this beautiful network that develops where, you know, if one of our coaches has a client that just has too much trauma that they need to work with, we do have clinicians who enroll. So they often will just refer them into the clinician in our community so they can work with that clinician as well. So there's also, I think, what I continue to learn is this, even what I mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, this collaborative spirit, the importance of a network, the importance of knowing that we are in this together with a community of people, I think is central to what it is that we're building at Third Wave. Because the truth is, we as an individual cannot handle the full complexity of what a psychedelic experience illuminates or brings up. And that it is about the community. It is about, you know, knowing that we have support. And I think that for me, that is my deeper why for all of this, right? For the third wave of psychedelics, for our, you know, for the business stuff, for being on podcasts, it's really communicating the importance of family, the importance of community, the importance of connection, because at the end of the day, I think that is the real medicine, and psychedelics are simply the tool that helps us to remember the importance of it.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I want to thank you for everything that you've shared today and for your time and for the great discussion that we've had. And before I ask you if there's anything that's been left out, I just want to ask you that since you've got so much going on, from your own podcast to Third Wave and, you know, these training programs and all this, and I know you've got your 7-hour session coming up, and maybe that's part of the answer, but I'm just curious, what do you like to do to nourish yourself outside of all of this busy work and application?
It's interesting. When I didn't realize how encompassing psychedelics would become when I started to work on Third Wave in 2015, because even, you know, about a week and a half from now, I'm going down to Mexico. And, you know, a lot of people think, oh yeah, he's going for a vacation, you know, travel. No, I'm going to do ayahuasca, I'm doing 2 ayahuasca ceremonies and going to Mexico. So there is a way where I've had to learn boundaries and how to create some space. I mean, I love to read, and I read some books about psychedelics, but most of what I read now is not necessarily specific to psychedelics. I love to travel, and not necessarily just for psychedelic retreats, but I love movement. Working out, going to the beach. What else? I have a pretty deep, I would say, meditative and breathwork contemplative practice that I cultivate that helps me to stay grounded and centered. I love parties. I love to have fun. I'm an introvert like you, but if it's something that's really special, if there's great music, if there's great dancing, I'm always there. And finally, I love to spend time with my family. You know, I've been traveling for years now. I left Michigan when I was 21. That's where I grew up, in Grand Rapids. And about 1 or 2 times a year, I end up seeing my family. We'll do a family trip, or I go back to Michigan because my parents and my sisters are all in Michigan. And so I just love to spend time with them. I love to spend time with my niece. And I'm in this interesting period. I'm 32 at the moment, where in the next few years, I really want to have a family, because I feel like I've sort of reached the end of this road, if you will, of travel, nomad, you know, single, free spirit. And what I'm really looking forward to in terms of something that really root me and ground me and bring a lot more meaning is family, having a partner, having kids, and having a home. I haven't lived in a place longer than I think 6 months for the last 10 years, just because I'm in an Airbnb here or sublease here or whatnot. And so I'm really looking forward to rooting and settling and family in the next few years.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. Well, good luck with all that, Paul.
Thank you, Martin.
Yeah. So let's bring it to a conclusion here and just remind everybody, we've been speaking about mastering microdosing, how to use subperceptual, going to be changing, psychedelics to heal trauma, improve performance, and transform your life by Paul F. Austin. And the correlating website that we've got here, which just looks like a great resource for all of this, is thethirdwave.co. And that's all one word, The Third Wave. And you can even just click on the molecule that you want to research. It's all right here. So it's nice, clean, well-organized. And of course, if people want to get involved and become a coach, this would seem to be the place to go. Anything else that we're leaving out that you'd like to mention before we sign off here?
Only that we have a newsletter that we send out every Sunday. So, and in that newsletter, we'll, we, We have a podcast that we do every week. We have some articles and blogs. We also have a directory of providers. So on Third Wave, if someone is looking for a clinic or a retreat or a coach or a therapist to work with as part of their experience, they can also find a provider in our directory. And those are vetted, verified. It's not like we just put anyone and everyone up there. They go through a process to ensure they're trustworthy and reputable and do good work. And then they have a chance to be listed.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Paul. It's been great speaking with you and getting to know you.
Thank you, Martin.